Hello, I'm David Rothenberg, and I want to invite you to attend a special performance of a new movie that will be a benefit for listener-sponsored WBAI. Released, the title of the movie, is a filming of the play The Castle, with a cast of three men and one woman, who between them have spent over 60 years in New York State prisons, but reclaimed their lives at the Fortune Academy, which the residents call The Castle. There will be two performances to benefit WBAI. The first will be Saturday, May 11th at 3 p.m., and the second will be the following day, Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. It will be at the Quad Theater at 34 West 13th Street. Tickets for the benefit are $20 a person, with proceeds going to WBAI. Please call 212-255-4834 for your ticket reservations. Hope to see you at the Quad Theater on Saturday, May 11th or Sunday, May 12th.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
WBAI is een niet-commerciële zender, gesponsord door de luisteraars.
Ciao, sono Letizia, e quando sono a New York, ascolto WBAI su 99.5 FM.
Nitwa Jacqueline Murekatete, ndi umurescapi wa genocide y'Abatutsi yabaye muri 1994 mu Rwanda.
Murimo kumva. Kuka tusam v New York, as vinegi slušam WBAI 96.5.
Mi nombre ta Ilse, anto sempre mi timi radio sintonisa na 99.5 FM WBAI.
What language do you speak when you call back home and talk to your grandmother or cousins? Join WBAI's ongoing community outreach and produce a station ID for us in your native tongue. You can contact the program coordinator, Michael G. Haskins, at wbaiannouncements@gmail.com. Let's celebrate each other.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
And it's exactly 7 o'clock, time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. It couldn't get much worse.
A very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Mike.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Bernie S. somewhere. Bernie S. Oh, wait, hang on. I didn't press the right button. Say whatever you just said again, Bernie.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
All right, great. And this is actually the first day that it's really warm, and we discovered that there's no air conditioning in our new studios up here in Harlem, but we're going to try and cram as many people in here as possible to see just how hot it actually gets. We've got some special guests. Mitch Altman joins us.
Hello.
And Andrew Zahn is here.
Hi, everyone.
And our friend Alex returns after years.
Hello.
Well, let's catch up, first of all. Alex, since people might be familiar with your voice, and if they're not, maybe I should go back about 10 years and listen to some of the other shows. What have you been up to?
Quite a bit. I think the last time I was here, we were talking about Shepard Fairey.
I don't even know what that is.
He was the guy who made the Obama image.
You got to talk into the microphone. That hasn't changed.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Excellent. Well, I've been doing some interesting stuff. I took a year off practicing law, went over to Oxford, finished another law degree, came back to New York, spent about 5 years in private practice.
So, well, you're a lawyer now.
I am indeed.
Well, yeah. we could use you for a few things. You remember all the trouble we used to get into, and we still do on
absolutely,
occasion.
Well,
okay,
absolutely.
We'll talk after the show. But what kinds of things do you specialize in?
Well, I've been doing a lot of internet governance law. I actually specialize in internet security and IT law now, but I'm doing a fair amount of commercial bits, privacy, data security, the usual stuff a former hacker with 2600 would probably do.
It disturbs me that you say former hacker.
I agree. Once you know, I regretted that. I regretted it as I said it. Yeah. I knew you were about to harp on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, retraction is a do.
Well, that's what lawyers are good at, retracting statements. All right, we'll definitely be asking your opinions on a lot of issues we talk about tonight and probably in the future as well. Mitch, it's been a while since we've seen you. Are you on one of your epic travel journeys again?
I am. I'm in New York for a week after recharging 2,000 TV Be Gone Pro batteries in New Jersey.
How do you recharge 2,000 batteries?
Hopefully with the help of a few friends, which I had. And I have to make sure they don't go too low so that they stay nice for end users to be able to recharge them. And they're all ready for people to use and turn off TVs everywhere they go from 100 meters away. So, so I did that. And in a week, I'm going to go to the UK and do a bunch of workshops and talks, including the UK Maker Faire, which, by the way, does not take military money, and at hackerspaces around the UK.
So let me see if I understand this. You don't participate in the Maker Faire in the United States because they take military money, but the Maker Faire in the UK does not.
Yeah, they're separate organizations.
Interesting. Is that true of Maker Faires everywhere, like Japan and various other countries?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure, but there's at least three different O'Reillys that are loosely affiliated. There's one in the U.S., O'Reilly Media.
O'Reilly owns Make.
They own Make magazine. They also publish a lot of really cool geek books. And until recently, O'Reilly doesn't own Make anymore. They split off. It's Maker Media that owns Make and Maker Faire now as of a few months ago.
Well, when you split off, this always confuses me. A company owns another company and they split off. Don't they still own that company? They just aren't saying it? Like if Time and Warner split off again, wouldn't they still somehow be affiliated with each other?
Well, I am not a lawyer, so I don't know. I think it depends on the agreement that they have. They can be totally split. I don't know. The Maker Media people and O'Reilly people haven't told me under the scenes what's going on, so I don't know.
All right. Well, interesting interesting things to talk about. Well, hopefully we'll have time to get into that a little bit more. Andrew Zahn joins us as well.
Hello.
You gave some presentations at the last HOPE conference, not the last HOPE conference, HOPE number 9.
Yes.
Last year. And one of the things that you just brought in today is the long-awaited book that some of our listeners pledged for in a recent fund drive. It's an art-based book having to do with hackers. It's called Hack, a Technology-Based Design and Art Exhibition. It looks really, really cool. How would you describe this on the radio? I see lots of photography here, and it's very well laid out.
Well, it's kind of an exhibition catalog for this exhibition that I organized last year for Philly Tech Week. And we're doing it again this year, and it's called Hack Philly. I'm kind of trying to pull away the word Philly from it because it's we opened it up to people outside of Philly, where last year it was really specific to Philadelphia, hackers and artists and technology-based artists and stuff like that. And so this book is basically kind of like trying to legitimize hacker artists and kind of pull them into the mainstream art world somehow, or at least that was my kind of, some kind of reason for doing this. And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but
we'll leave history to judge that, I suppose. Yeah. Bernie, you're in Philadelphia. Are you familiar with this event?
I am very familiar with it and connected with the Hacktory, which I've been involved with here in Philly. And it's several of the artists involved with the Hack exhibition I'm familiar with, and it was a really good. I wasn't at the event; I was tied up out of town, but I heard it was a good event. And it's just a coincidence here that Mitch and I went to the Philadelphia Free Library, where they were having a big meeting on how to put a hackerspace in the free library there, And that's where we met Andrew, and the rest is history.
Exactly. Indeed. Okay. Well, Andrew, hopefully we'll see you next year when we do another Hope Conference, as yet unnamed. But tell us, do you plan on doing more hacker art type things?
Yes. Actually, so in a couple weeks on April 27th in Philly, if you go to hackphilly.com, you can find out about it. It's the second, it's Hack 2.0, which I was trying to be as creative as possible in thinking of that name. And so this year, it's there's actually the kind of big deal hacker artists that are in the show this year are actually from New York. They're called Lovid, and it's a husband and wife kind of video art duo, and they're in the show. And there's a bunch of other people, and it should be really good. So.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad so many people are here. It's like old times, and we can prove that we actually can fit a lot of people into this studio. So hopefully we'll have many more such discussions, and hopefully we'll have more to talk about today. But right now, it's important that we look at what's been going on, which certainly has a technological bent to it. And, of course, I'm talking about the events that happened in Boston a couple of days ago. Very tragic, unfortunate events, and technology is certainly going to be used in interesting ways, and we have to kind of analyze that. First, I wanted to know if anyone saw this headline in today's Telegraph from the UK. Apparently, Barack Obama is sending letters with ricin. It says, Barack Obama sent letter containing ricin. Yeah, isn't that weird that he's the one doing it, apparently, according to this newspaper?
You think you know a guy.
Yeah. No, actually, it's just, I guess, a different way of phrasing it. He was sent a letter containing ricin, supposedly. But again, you know, with the media, what they say one day will be refuted the next day. We've seen so many facts that turned out not to be facts as far as this whole bombing thing, how many packages there were, what was happening, what wasn't happening. Today, we heard in the mass media that they had found the person who did it. Then they had to correct that and say, no, actually, they didn't find anybody. You have to wonder how the media gets their information in the first place. Are they just going on Twitter or something, or social media? And that's what they're doing. You see, there was an interesting article from the mass media talking about how social media basically was sending out all these fake stories. But what they really didn't focus on was that the mass media was believing it and spreading it around and really doing most of the work as far as this goes. Stories like this, you have to do some fact-checking. There's no shortcuts, and I think that's what we learn every time there's a crisis like this. So when you hear something, you can never believe it until it's been investigated thoroughly, backed up, and confirmed. Bernie, anything that stands out for you?
I thought it was pretty – well, the events were tragic. I was following what was going on, and I was intrigued to hear the Associated Press was reporting that the cell phone networks around the Boston area were shut down purposely to prevent additional bombs from being detonated using cell phones. Like
and again, that was not true. That actually did not happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Later that day, and they even quoted an unnamed law enforcement official who said he was in a federal law enforcement briefing about what was going on, and it turned out not to be true at all. The carriers said no, that didn't happen at all. People weren't able to get their calls through because so many people are trying to make calls, which is happens all too often because they don't have enough capacity. And so that wasn't true. And
well, let's just address that for a second, as far as because this is always reported when there are situations like this. What is the connection between cell phones and exploding bombs? Is there a connection?
It's only really theoretical as far as I know. I mean, there were cell phones reportedly used at some of the subway bombings, maybe in Barcelona or maybe the ones in London, I forget which, where the cell phone timers were used. You know, you could set an alarm, like go off like an hour or something, and that was set to turn on a relay that would set off the explosive. But somehow this has been sort of misinterpreted or twisted into thinking that cell phones were being used to remotely detonate bombs, which really wouldn't be very reliable because based on my experience with cell phones, especially in subways where they don't work at all most of the time. So it's kind of a bogus. It's much more like you could easily, this is easily use a wristwatch or an egg timer or an alarm clock.
You're saying it's just the timing mechanism that's on a cell phone. You don't even have to be connected to a network for that to actually work.
I've tried to follow this use of cell phone story for a long time since 9/11, and all the times where cell phones were reported having been used, it was the timer feature that was being used in them, not like calling it to set it off from another place.
So you'd have to have a cell phone attached to the explosive that the timer would count down and.
Have a couple of wires attached. I don't want to go into too much detail, but you'd have a couple of wires attached to the speaker that would set off a relay when the alarm went off, or to the vibrator motor or something like that. I mean, this isn't something that anybody can't look up on the internet already. But it's just sort of an overreactionary thing. If anything, people need to be able to communicate in these kinds of situations. It's counterproductive.
Right. Well,
communication.
The reason I'm interested in this, and the reason we're focusing attention on it, is because when there's a situation like this, when there's an emergency of any sort, when your public safety is at risk, people are more liable to say, yes, by all means, turn off the cell phone networks because that'll keep us safe. And in actuality, we're being fed misinformation, it seems, yet again. There doesn't seem to be an actual instance of the cell phone network being used somehow to trigger an explosive, unless there's something that we're missing here.
I've never read or heard of a confirmed report of a cell phone being used to set off a bomb remotely in any terrorist type of attack.
Okay, if any of our listeners know otherwise, if you've been involved in such things, let us know, because we'd like to have some facts on our side. Rob?
And the reason something like that is believable, though, I think, is because a cell phone is something that everyone has, and most people don't know much about it, like on a technical level. So if you say something like, okay, the cell phones are the cause of this, or the cell phones are letting this happen, people are more likely to look at that and go, well, okay, there must be something to this. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, it might have been transistor radios or something like that. And it's just something widespread that I think they can cause a little consternation with.
It could be all sorts of things that are defined as dangerous, such as dissent, saying too much or thinking too much. And in situations like this, where everybody is scared and concerned, you're more liable to rein yourself in and think that, that's the right thing to do. And in actuality, it's precisely the wrong thing to do. So, and the other thing, obviously, that we need to focus upon is surveillance, because this could be checkmate for people that want more surveillance in our cities. I want every move to be scrutinized. Now, Bernie, I'm going to pose this question to you. We have a situation now where they're looking for the guy that did this, and they're relying on surveillance to find him. Now, how would you say that we're going to find somebody like this without putting up more cameras and more facial recognition?
Well, I would argue that it doesn't make us any safer to have more surveillance, because it doesn't prevent anybody from doing anything. It's all, maybe it might be helpful after the fact to find somebody who did it, and then it's kind of a long shot. All the reports I'm hearing is most of the video and pictures that are being used and looked at are by people who were taking the pictures, like reporters and amateur journalists, just people taking pictures around there and videos, because it was the Boston Marathon. There were probably thousands of people taking videos and pictures, and that's what the FBI is mostly coming through. Yeah, a lot of businesses have, and like ATM machines have cameras in them, and they have been used to try to find perpetrators of crimes, but people happen to be walking by a camera or something. But I don't buy that more surveillance and other technologies like facial identification that can be tied into closed-circuit TV cameras, I don't buy that it makes us safer. It might help investigating it after the fact.
Well, don't you think that's enough for most people, that they really want to know who this guy is, and that with that technology, that makes it possible?
I think it's a good question, but I really would not feel any safer. I would feel more paranoid if there were more cameras pointing everywhere, identifying who I am, where I go. It's just a real slippery slope. It raises some good questions that I'm glad we're talking about it here, but it doesn't make us safer in the end. I don't believe that at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not going to prevent somebody from doing this in a variety of places, but again, I'm wondering if that's going to be enough to argue against installing more surveillance cameras. If people are told that the only reason they finally catch this guy is because of the surveillance, it's going to be really, really difficult to say, yeah, we're better off without it. Mike?
But I mean, it's not just surveillance
microphone, Mike.
In this case. The people who are not from or have been to Boston might not understand, like, Boston really cares about people running in a straight line for 26 miles. It's a major event. There are a lot of cameras of all types at the finish line. And so I don't know, the footage they finally found may not be from surveillance cameras, maybe just from someone who happened to be filming at the time or from a television crew or whatever. So it's not even clear that this is a victory for surveillance, if you want to allow such a thing to exist.
Well, it would be interesting. But, you know, again, even if it's not something they find through surveillance cameras, even if it's something they find through people's iPhones, the argument will be made that, well, we could have done better if we had more surveillance cameras. You know, I just think we need to be prepared for this, because this is something where surveillance is really going to be held up high and as our savior. And I've seen this in London. I've seen this in London, where you can't walk a foot without being on some kind of camera. Alex, you've seen that. You were over in the UK for a while.
Yeah, in fact, it's actually a bit of a funny story. When I was over at New College at Oxford a few years ago, I was tasked with an old school kind of thing, escorting around the former Chief Justice of the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, this guy Theodore Mehran. He was a professor at NYU, and so I had to escort him to have tea at All Souls College, and we were walking through the famous, walking past the famous Radcliffe camera in Oxford, and I was talking to Professor Mehran and about how, you know, there are CCTV cameras all over Oxford now, and I said, as an indication, I said, look at those beautiful light posts up there, those kind of old-school-looking light posts, those really, you know, probably from the 19th century. He said, yeah, those are very nice. I said, those are actually cameras. And here was the Chief Justice.
From the 19th century?
No. They were made to look like lights from the 19th century, but they just had CCTV cameras installed basically to watch the Radcliffe camera. And he was appalled. I mean, absolutely appalled. But it was nice to see a real jurist, in the ICTY, being completely appalled by this type of
thing. Okay, but he's appalled, but the cameras aren't coming down. Once those are put up, they stay.
I imagine they do.
And I've seen situations, I think Philadelphia might have been one of them, Bernie, where citizens demand more cameras because they think that makes their neighborhood safe. Why hasn't our neighborhood gotten more cameras? Why only the well-to-do neighborhoods?
And it's I was in some of the community meetings about that. The citizens were not demanding more cameras. The police were demanding more cameras.
Well, it depends where you go. It depends what channels you watch, because they do show people demanding more cameras.
Yes, the police were demanding more cameras and more money for them, and with the promise that it would make people safer. And people were like, yes, we want cameras because the police state will make us safer. But they really weren't getting made safer. So, yes, people were clamoring on it based on misinformation, and that's what we have to be on guard for.
All right. There's also a somewhat related story involving the FBI. A team of privacy advocates and experts is launching a lawsuit against the FBI for refusing to provide information to the public about its new next-generation identification system, which the federal agency says is in demand for its biometric database of Americans. Yeah, the lawsuit filed against the FBI in Washington, D.C. by our friends at the Electronic Privacy Information Center is asking for a court order that information about the program's contracts with private companies and its technical specifications be made available. It's not asking to stop it, just asking for information about it. Epic said that the NGI system, upon completion, will be the largest biometric database in the world. It will include files of fingerprints, DNA profiles, iris scans, palm prints, voice identification profiles, photographs, and other identifying information already collected by states, counties, and even schools. The FBI will use facial recognition to match images in the database against facial images obtained from CCTV and elsewhere, according to Epic. The complaint explains that the FBI announced in 2009 the NGI system was being created to record, analyze, and use biometrics of U.S. citizens, whether they know that their details have been recorded or not, using an estimated 30 million spy cameras across the United States. It's boggling to the mind to hear these kinds of things.
So, I mean, we're seeing here what we've seen so many times. It's almost not fair to call it a double standard, because it's really two completely separate and unrelated standards. One standard is what the powerful people want to be able to know about us, which is everything, and what they want us to know about them, which is quite literally nothing. They would probably prefer if we didn't even know the system exists. We talked about this before with the giant data center that the NSA is building in Utah, which they, I mean, it's such a big thing that it's fairly obvious that it exists. But anyone who tries to get any information about what they're going to do with it, not necessarily the content contained therein, maybe there's a reason to keep that secret, but just the basic capabilities of the system, who or what is the, at the highest level, the NSA going to be spying on. And they don't want us to know even that. They don't want Congress to know even that. And this is the pattern that we're seeing over and over again, and I really wish I knew how to stop it.
That's something I think a lot of us wish. Alex?
Another thing that I think is interesting, and building on what Mike had said, is that the whole purpose of this program appears to be to collect personally identifying information. And this is information that most forward-looking legal systems require the consent of the individual to obtain. And then most forward-looking legal systems also require that information to be carefully safeguarded and used for only proper purposes. It seems like the FBI has an exemption to this. I mean, why should we trust them any more than we would trust Google or Yahoo or Microsoft or anybody or your local grocer with personally identifying information of this sort? I mean, it seems very, very dangerous.
Use of the word forward-looking, forward-thinking, legal systems seem to be deliberately chosen to exclude the United States.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, the state-by-state privacy laws can be, you know, varying, and some of them are quite a bit different from others. But for the most part, you know, Europe has really led the charge when it comes to privacy-related legislation.
I'm glad you brought up Google, because there's an interesting development. Not really a development. This is something that isn't all that new, but it's becoming a little bit more evident and obvious. Maybe people will wake up a little bit. But this whole thing known as CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Security Protection Act, there's a battle raging around that. But it turns out that, well, certain organizations support it. They support this invasion of our privacy, and among them, Microsoft, Yahoo, and our friends at Google. Absolutely. TechNet, the bipartisan policy and political network of technology CEOs that promotes the growth of the innovation economy, commends you for your work on cybersecurity and rights to express our support of CISPA, said Ray Ramsey, who is the president of a lobbying group that includes Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo. Now, CISPA is basically, you'll be hearing more about that in the news, but there's a lot of opposition to it. It doesn't seem to be as organized as the opposition against SOPA. Bernie, have you noticed the same thing?
Yes, SOPA was very well organized against, and I'm a little concerned because we've lost some people like Aaron Swartz, who were very, very key in fighting against such negative legislation. So, and I'm also disturbed that Google seems to have been making about face in the CISPA legislation. Before, they were, at least if they weren't against it, they weren't on board with it. And now they're on board with it and bringing others on board with them. So this is not a good trend.
I've seen it mentioned in a number of times, a number of occasions, that that Google was key in stopping SOPA because Google came out against it, and that since they're not coming out, in fact, let me read from this story here: the protest against CISPA isn't nearly as unified as protests against SOPA. Some of the sites have played a key role in SOPA protests, like Reddit and Craigslist, have urged their visitors to oppose CISPA, but they're not joined by Google this time, and that could make the difference. Some SOPA lobbyists, like the Motion Picture Association of America, have indicated they feel Google alone was responsible for SOPA's defeat. It's really kind of crazy that Google is determining all, and it does seem like they are determining what will pass and what will not, but they have a ton of money and a lot of support from people, and a lot of people blindly follow them. Mike?
I think that really oversimplifies. I think in the world of the MPAA, there is only large entities. So there is the motion picture studios, and they can sort of understand the existence of Google, which is a giant corporation which doesn't care about people. They want to believe, and they must believe, that the opposition cannot be ordinary folks. And what's worrying, what compounds this difficulty is that, like, the rest of us have lives. Like, we fought SOPA, and we're like, all right, we're going to take a year off and not worry about this for a little while. But the lobbyists for the people who want control, they have nothing else to do. If they took a year off, they wouldn't be able to bill. They wouldn't be able to do anything. So they are trying all the time to make new bad laws, and the rest of us can only try some of the time to prevent new bad laws, and that's where the problem's
coming. I don't accept that. I'm sorry. We don't take time off. I think people who are awake are always paying attention. It's just a question of which one do you focus on. I think there's too many to focus on, but CISPA has been front and center as far as bad things to oppose. Now, just so people know what CISPA is all about, and anyone please jump in if you have further details, it's a proposed law here in the good old USA that allows for the sharing of all kinds of internet traffic information between the U.S. government, certain technology and manufacturing companies, is according to Wikipedia. The stated aim of the bill is to help the U.S. government investigate cyber threats and ensure the security of networks against cyber attack. Problem is that by having this kind of monitoring, you're not monitoring just the bad guys, you're monitoring everybody. And that seems to be fine and good with companies like Facebook and Google that already collect all this information on everybody. I think too many people just think that's too much to oppose, that so many people are voluntarily giving all this information away. So maybe they don't see the threat. That's what worries me, that people don't see this as a threat. Alex?
I think what can account for some of the reluctance by private industry to oppose the CISPA bill are the, and I don't remember the exact details of them off the top of my head, but the immunity provisions that it contains, namely that if you give certain data to the government and you cooperate with this program, if there is some kind of breach, you will not have liability. You'll have immunity. So that, this liability for data breaches and things could really amount to an incredible amount of money. So they have an incentive not to oppose this bill in the manner that they did with SOPA. In that sense, the House was very, very smart in the way it crafted it. It gave financial incentives for companies to support it, not only to not oppose it, but and if I recall correctly, I think it passed a House committee vote this past Thursday.
Well, interesting development, too, is that the White House is threatening to veto it. And I'm curious what our reaction to that might be. Yesterday, the White House threatened a veto against CISPA. Basically, as we said, it's intended to improve cybersecurity through information sharing. The White House warned lawmakers the president won't sign the measure unless changes are made to protect privacy and civil liberties. The bill would free companies and the federal government to swap data about cyber threats, giving them a broader role, giving the federal government a broader role in helping banks, manufacturers, and other businesses protect themselves. But the White House, echoing privacy advocates, said the bill fails to require irrelevant personal information to be removed before data is sent to the government or other companies. I'm always dubious of good news, but this sounds like good news. Anyone care to dispute that this is a good development, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, this move on the part of the administration infuriates me because, wait, no, this sounds kind of okay,
right,
actually.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, too.
I wasn't expecting that.
I didn't know. This doesn't, they really care, or there's something else here. Mitch?
Yeah, well, I'm always skeptical when I hear something like that. I kind of wonder if it's just they are threatening to veto it because of other aspects of the bill, and they're just saying that so they can get points from people who are into civil liberties. I guess there's a few of us.
Well, yeah. How many? I'd like to know. Mike?
So here's a few ways to maybe focus your skepticism, Mitch. I'm wondering if they're setting themselves up so that some tiny concession will be made and they can say, hey, we watched out for your civil liberties while the overall evil in the bill still passes. And the other thing to worry about is that even if this bill is vetoed, there'll be another president. We can't rely on the veto of the president, who has in general not shown himself to be a huge fan of civil liberties, to keep ourselves safe. So,
all right. Well, again, quoting the White House here, citizens have a right to know that the corporations will be held accountable and not granted immunity for failing to safeguard personal information adequately. And I say amen to that. I say amen if that is in fact what they mean when they say that. Yes, Bernie.
I would like to point out that our President Obama also came out against telecom immunity during that whole NSA spying thing. Geez, it was like, what, 5 years ago? And he did in a complete about-face and then voted in the U.S. Senate for telecom immunity. So that.
But now he's about-faced again, so he's facing the same way? He's turned in a circle? Is that right?
I guess he's done a 360 now. He's probably getting dizzy at this point. So, you know, it's hard for me to take this administration at face value when they have in the past, in similar instances, said that they're against huge corporations being held, not being held liable for violating privacy laws, and then having no problem with it later. It's just really hard for me to take it with the, I have to take it with a grain of salt.
Well, let's see if it actually happens. If it does happen, then we can say that's a good thing, and we need more good things like that. Fingers crossed. Okay, our friends at the Internal Revenue Service apparently believe that their agents don't need warrants to read people's emails, text messages, and other private electronic communications. That's according to internal agency documents obtained by the ACLU through a Freedom of Information Act request. In a 2009 handbook, the IRS said the Fourth Amendment does not protect emails because Internet users do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in such communications. Now, I find that interesting. Now, does that mean that any time, say, a hacker gets into someone's computer system and reads emails, no crime is committed because there's no expectation of privacy, right? I mean, it's got to work both ways, right? I want to see, Alex, will a lawyer use that as a defense maybe?
It sounds reasonable to me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I wonder what caused them to come up with this crazy idea in a 2009 handbook. It's very interesting.
It's their God complex.
It must be. I mean, maybe they were looking at this exception to privacy, which is known as the business records exception, and reading that into email, which essentially is the same exception that allows people to access your library records and video store rentals. Remember those? Is that these are business records in the possession of a third party or your telephone records. So you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy because you've already essentially waived it by giving these records to a third party. Maybe somehow they've extended that reasoning to emails because they reside on a server somewhere. But, I mean, it just flies in the face of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence since Al Gore invented the Internet.
Well, yes. they are using the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA from 1986, something that we're rather familiar with. According to that, in their eyes, government officials only need a subpoena issued without a judge's approval to read emails that have been opened or that are more than 180 days old. But organizations like the ACLU argue that the Fourth Amendment provides greater privacy protections than the ECPA and that officials should need a warrant to access all emails and other private messages. So, yeah, that's the battle of minds that's going on in the legal world. Mike?
I mean, so people who remember who've been on the Internet a long time, the way the email used to work is that you would download all your email to your computer and you would read it on your computer. And so that if they tried to get your email from the from your Internet service provider, it wouldn't be there anymore. For most people these days, that's not the way they use email. The email just stays on Google or Yahoo or whoever it is forever. And so this law, which was like sort of moderately bad when it was written, is really terrible now.
All right. Bernie, I think I might have disconnected you, and hopefully this is Bernie that called back.
Yeah, yes, it is.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I was.
I heard Mike starting to bring up something that I was, and I guess you mentioned that this would only really, if the IRS's theory is even correct, which I don't think it is legally correct, it could be limited just to emails that are on a server somewhere as opposed to those that are on your personal hard drive, in your computer, in your home, that would clearly be protected under the Fourth Amendment.
Yes. Okay.
Sure.
All right. We're going to take phone calls. But first, I want to know if anybody had heard about this Boston bombing-related incident involving a television show known as Family Guy. Fox Television has pulled a recent episode of the animated series from TV and internet sites after unrelated clips that were edited together to depict the bombing at the Boston Marathon went viral on the web. And good luck finding that now because, well, Google controls YouTube and pretty much everything else. And you can't watch it anywhere because it's basically been deleted unless you taped it yourself. So another indication why it's a bad idea to depend on the cloud for things that you want to see. Now, according to a Fox spokesperson, they said the network pulled a Turban Cowboy episode of the satirical series Family Guy from Fox.com and Hulu.com and everywhere else. And they have no plans on rebroadcasting it ever. It's not known who posted them, as if that was a crime. Basically, I think it falls under fair use to edit something together in a albeit a tasteless way, but somewhat unique and creative. The edited video shows two separate clips fused together from that episode, which aired back in March, in which the lead character drunkenly drives over runners in order to win the Boston Marathon. But later in the episode, an unconnected storyline, that same character unknowingly becomes friends with an extremist who gives him a cell phone, which he then calls, and explosions are heard. So I think in that same exact scenario, here it is again, where cell phones are detonating things. But, you know, all done in a comedic way. But it's funny that the people who put out the show don't think it's funny now because someone else did something tasteless. You know, there's going to be tasteless remarks and jokes and all sorts of things after this tragic event, as well as beforehand. What concerns me here is controlling how we see things and saying you're not allowed to watch this, you're not allowed to have this, you're not allowed to do this, and just it gets more and more complete. You know, year after year, it gets to the point where if something is ruled too controversial for us, you won't be able to find it anywhere because those entities control virtually every way that you are able to get it. We may not be there yet, but I think maybe in another 5 years, it'll be completely impossible to post this even on your own site. We'll have to see. So we're going to open up the phones, 212-650-5782. I see someone's already online, so let's answer the phone. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Oh, wow. That's what happens when you call so early. You get disconnected. It does happen. That's what Verizon does. They disconnect you after a few rings. We only have one incoming line, so I have to babble a bit while you're waiting for the... there it is. And we can hear the phone ringing still. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
Pleasure to listen to you, as always. I wanted to say, I think that there was an instance where a cell phone itself was used as a bomb against a Palestinian... I don't know if he was an activist, leader, what have you, but like over 10 years ago.
Yeah, the Israeli government, right.
Yeah, the Israeli government.
It was in the early 90s. It was a PLO, some top guy in the PLO that the Israelis put the explosives inside his cell phone. It was part of the battery pack, and they were able to swap his cell phone battery out, and then they called him and blew his head off.
So, right, yeah, wait, exactly. So was the call what triggered the explosive?
Yes, but the bomb was in the phone itself. It was it's something only the Mossad would have come up with. But
how did they give him the phone in the first place?
It was his own phone, but they got some infiltrator to come in and swap out the battery in the cell phone, and the new battery was part battery and part bomb that could detect when it received the next call.
Well, how about when he pushed the button that said talk? Maybe that was the button that said blow up.
Well, no, I don't think you can do that just by replacing the battery. But in any case, they called him and blew his head off. But, yeah, that is one exception. You could argue, though, that that wasn't a terrorist event. I'm sure the Israelis would argue it was not a terrorist event.
It was a military operation from their point of view.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. But on the general discussion, this is a really, really, really important, really fascinating discussion in terms of surveillance, the implications of it, the harm it does, the good it can do in attempting to find a perpetrator, such as what occurred tragically in Boston a few days ago. And, you know, all the positives and negatives need to really be fleshed out, because I'm totally against surveillance and totally, you know, against this notion of, you know, the state playing God with all of their facial recognition technology and cameras on every corner. However, you know, it's not something that could just be kind of swept to the side, the question of, well, how do you go about catching a perpetrator of something like this if you don't have the digital forensics, so to speak, to follow up on? So, you know, I mean, I'm very distrustful of Big Brother, but it's just a very deep thing that I hope one of the guys from your community writes a book about it or something, because it's never-endingly deep.
I think the other thing to remember also is that you can never stop this kind of thing from happening in the first place. You will never be able to completely get rid of or even remotely get rid of the number of people that want to blow things up if a lot of people want to blow things up. And we're fortunate that not many people want to do that, that this is the first time in I can't remember how long something like this has happened. Back in the 1970s, people were blowing things up a lot more than they are now, in New York City even. And you know, it wasn't – I have tape recordings as a kid. I recorded the all-news station. And, yeah, somebody blew up an airport terminal or a bag in an airport terminal, and it was the top story. But after 5 minutes, they went on to another story. It wasn't even that big a deal. Not saying it's not a big deal. I'm saying that certain things don't change over time. There's always going to be crazy people, and you can never stop that. What you can do, though, you can destroy your society, and you can become people who are in fear constantly and controlled by the government.
Mike. I mean, it should be pointed out that the U.S. government blows things up on a very regular basis.
Yeah, not usually in our streets, but...
Not usually in the U.S. They usually do it overseas, but they're pretty good at it, so...
Yeah, and that's another thing to consider, too, that, you know, the fear that people are experiencing now is something that many people in the world experience on a daily basis and with much, much bigger numbers. And it doesn't make anything right, doesn't justify anything, but it's just something to consider that that's actually a step closer to reality than the peace that we live in every single day. All right, let's take another phone call. 212-650-5782. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Why are people calling with dial tones? Or maybe they're just calling really and letting the phone ring a long time. I'm sorry. 212-650-5782. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi. Yes. Regarding the marathon end and why they may have shut off the cell phones, it may not have been because the cell phone per se would detonate a bomb, but if you've ever been around construction sites, they always say turn off cell phones. It may be because of stray RF, possibly accidentally setting off something unstable.
Okay, interesting point. Bernie, what do you think about that?
Actually, no. The RF energy emitted by a cell phone is very, very tiny. It was true back in the day, you know, decades ago with explosives they used dynamiting for like quarries and things like that. You'd see signs, don't use two-way radios. But back, yes. You know, those were radios that were like several watts. Your current cell phone typically in a metropolitan area only emits a few tens of milliwatts. It's really not enough to induce enough electrical energy into wires to set off a blasting cap or something.
But so, do they still tell you to turn off your cell phone if you're near a place like that?
That don't know what they're talking about, maybe.
Airplanes still impose a ban upon takeoff and landing of even operating an AM/FM radio. I've seen one AA battery actually interfere with some other appliance nearby. So it seems tiny, and it is, but it may be with certain unstable explosives, possibly trinitrate toluene, it might be enough theoretically to do something. I don't know how, you know, or navigation in a plane.
And we also heard a similar rumor about cell phones in gas stations, that they could ignite a gas pump to explode or something like that. And I believe Mythbusters dispelled that particular rumor, but maybe we need people to dispel this one as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks for your call. 212-650-5782. We're talking about the Boston bombing and the role of technology and privacy issues, surveillance, all that fun stuff. Good evening. You are on Off the Hook.
Yes. I think this kind of ridiculous statement by the IRS that people don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy is great, because now we get to define reasonable expectation of privacy as getting to encrypt everything. And that does not mean we're up to something wrong. It means, hey, I have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So you know the next push is going to be to outlaw encryption. This is a great line in the sand.
Well, it would be nice if it was made so simple that everyone's grandmother could do it without any fuss. I don't think we're there yet. And I call on hackers everywhere to develop something that is transparent, easy to use, and effective in keeping prying eyes from reading. What's that, Mitch?
And comes to fault in Firefox.
Uh-huh. Yes. I'm not sure what that means exactly.
Oh, you know, so you download Firefox, you install it, and it's automatically encrypted, you know, and same with Thunderbird. And
you mean the web pages you visit? Or
web pages and your email, you know, if it's automatically encrypted, you know, like most websites are HTTP, not secure. There's no reason why they can't all be HTTPS secure.
Well, I mean, when you conduct sales transactions online, by default, they are encrypted. They are protected, but the same does not hold true for email that is sent. It can be read in a variety of places as it passes from the sender to the receiver, and that's something that I think really we need to make priority number one. Alex,
and to go back to the original point of the caller about outlawing encryption, I think what's important to note: use of encryption is not outlawed, but it is important to note that the export of encryption over a certain strength is, in fact, regulated as a munition. So that can, quite frankly, be illegal to export.
Well, okay, fine. So we don't export it. Other countries can make their own encryption, but I'm talking about using it here domestically with our own citizens who don't use it nearly enough or at all. Okay, let's take another phone call, 212-650-5782. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, how are you today?
All right, how are you? Go ahead.
Good. I was just enjoying your show. I just wanted to go back a couple of callers back. He was talking about, privacy. Well, you guys are all talking about privacy. I'm also not a huge fan with the idea that the government's going to be looking over my shoulder and seeing everything. But we live in a society now where, you know, from a governmental point of view, they're trying to balance. And I'm not trying to play the government side here because I'm not worried about the government from a conspiracy point of view. But it's a slippery slope. As they take away freedoms, we lose them. We sort of give them up. Everybody gives all their stuff on Facebook and stuff like that and gives it up. So we've gotten used to giving it up inappropriately, in my opinion. But that's a personal opinion. But we also, you know, a bomb like this goes off or something happens and everybody's screaming for somebody's head, why didn't you protect us? So the government puts in more controls and more video cameras and more trying to get more privacy because they're trying to do the appropriate job. And when what it comes down to is if we want to keep our freedoms, then we have to also allow the fact that, like you said, you can't protect against everything and sometimes tragedies are going to occur.
I think looking towards Norway and how they dealt with that tragedy over there, it didn't change their society as far as I can see. They didn't get paranoid and have barriers built. They still try to live the same way they did. And I think there'd be no greater victory than to have twice as many people show up to the Boston Marathon next year without a single bit of added security to show that we're not afraid and that this security is not going to change anything. It's just going to take away more freedoms. But thanks very much for that point and for your call. 212-650-5782 is our telephone number, and we only have a few minutes left while we wait for that phone to ring again. There it is. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yes, hello.
It's Tom from the Bronx. How are you?
Yeah, I'd like to say this. It's interesting you brought up the story of the Family Guy, because when the tragedy happened in the college, what was that, Virginia?
Virginia Tech.
There was an episode of the new Knight Rider. Did you ever see the new Knight Rider?
Regrettably, no.
Well, it was around for a while. They had an episode that there was somebody that got into their headquarters and was killing the agents in the headquarters, and it mirrored the story of what happened in Virginia Tech. Now, I don't know whether anybody ever brought that up.
Well, what was similar? This, the fact that somebody was killing other people?
In other words, the way the individual had gotten into the installation of the headquarters, it was different than the old Knight Rider.
I can imagine, yeah.
And it mirrored the story of the true life. In other words, you'd have to see it to believe it.
Well, okay, one day maybe I'll see it, and maybe another day I'll believe it, but thanks for your call, 212-650-5782. We only have a couple minutes left. Let's take this phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Thanks for your call.
Hey, great show, guys.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Do you guys are for surveillance, or you're not for surveillance?
Yeah, it's not clear, is it?
To hide, it wouldn't be a problem. If you're on a video camera like what you brought up in England, Mm-hmm. What's the big deal if you're not doing anything illegal? But God forbid something like this happens, at least there's some type of video trail that people...
Well, that's the question I was asking Bernie before, you know. Okay, so if you didn't have this surveillance, how would you ever find the person who did this? Through people's individual cameras, through very good memory? We need an answer to that. Otherwise, we're going to see more surveillance cameras everywhere. Anyone want to take a stab, Mike?
I mean, so I'm not a policeman, in case anyone couldn't guess, but like crimes were solved before the invention of CCTV.
Uh-huh.
So it's clearly possible to solve.
It's possible, but it's also possible that crimes won't get solved. A lot of crimes don't get solved, but when you have every single movement under surveillance, the camera shows a guy putting a knapsack down in a garbage can. You wouldn't see that without the camera.
Right. And a lot of people were executed before DNA evidence. Now that DNA evidence has come with the scientific, and this is science, the science of technology. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have nothing to hide, of course, the government with Big Brother is dangerous, but when these guys use a pressure cooker, I mean, this talk about a recipe for disaster. I mean, who is this? I even heard that somebody was mad because possibly the New York Marathon was canceled, and the way Bloomberg went about this, with people spending all the money to come in and then they canceled it, maybe it was revenge against the New York man. I mean, who cares why a person would do this? It could be so they, obviously the person.
Is that really a theory because of the hurricane? That's the silliest theory I've ever heard.
No. Think about it. If the person is mentally ill enough to do this, if that was his reason, does it really matter? People are like, well, why would somebody do this? Well, there could be any reason. Obviously, they're mentally ill.
Well, yeah, then it could be because the guiding light got canceled. Who knows? But thanks for that call. Bernie, go ahead.
I just want to say, I really have a hard time understanding why people are afraid of getting blown up by terrorists. The risk assessment, if you look at it, more people died in Boston that day in random car accidents. Probably more people were maimed in Massachusetts that day from car accidents and other things than that one incident. It's the chances of anybody getting harmed or killed in a terrorist incident is so infinitesimal that it's not worth investing hundreds of billions of dollars for these technologies to supposedly keep us safer, which really aren't going to keep us safer and will only hurt our privacy.
While what you say is true, I think the way of saying it is not really going to convince a lot of people, and we need to think of a better way to say that. Yes, when you look at all the people who didn't get blown up in that area alone, okay, fine. But it's not much comfort to a lot of people who are witnessing it. Let's take a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Oh, another one. Wow. The dial tone seems to call more than anybody. 212-650-5782. Only have time for maybe one or two more phone calls. And Bernie, I'm sorry, I can't expand on this more because every time you start talking, someone calls and we can hear the phone ringing like that. So let's take that phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I'm on Off the Hook.
You are on the air now.
Oh, okay. Just want to say I didn't appreciate the sexist ageist comment.
The which?
The sexist and ageist comment.
Who made the sexist ageist comment?
Whoever it was who was speaking. I mean, I'm enjoying your show very much, but there was a comment made that that would be great if everybody in everybody's grandmother knew how to do it.
Well, how is that a sexist ageist comment? I'm talking about people's relatives, people who might not have the same experience with technology. As someone who's a teenager, which I suppose is another ageist comment.
I'll
say grandfather, okay? That'll get me 50% off the hook. How's that?
No.
Anyway, what else is on your mind?
Sorry. That's it. That's all I wanted to say.
Just okay.
Watch your language.
Thanks. Watch my language. Yeah, the language police are everywhere. Let's see if we can get one more call in. Oh, no, I hung up on Bernie again. I'm sorry, Bernie. This phone system is not doing what I want it to do. But let's take a call over here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to mention sort of the hypocrisy that I see in the government, you know, wanting to keep tabs on us and at the same time, not passing the gun control laws because people don't want background checks. It just seems kind of absurd.
Well, that's a whole show in and of itself. And, I'm sure you'll hear more about that here on this radio station. We're out of time, and apologies to Bernie for hanging up on him a second time. I guess he didn't have a certain button pressed that would have prevented that. I'll learn. I will. Alex, Andrew, Mitch, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
We'll see you again. We'll definitely
thank
see you at future Hope conferences. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. That is our email address. And please say whatever is on your mind, because it's certainly an interesting topic. oth@2600.com. Manuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. Have a good night.
Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're watching me on the telly. See me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting. Children dying every day. My name is nobody, but I can't wait to see your face inside my door. Oh. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you got me all in your notebook. Writing it down every day. Your name is I'll see
your name
you.
Is I'll see you.
I'll change if you vote me in as a president of your soul. I live in the ghetto. You just come to visit me round election time. Hi. My name is secluded. We live in a house the size of a matchbox. Roaches live with us wall to wall. You've killed all our leaders. I don't even have to do nothing to you. You'll cause your own country to fall.
Wow, I wish I could let that play a little bit more, because it was a fantastic song by none other than Stevie Wonder. So, you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, also streaming on the web at WBAI.org, also streaming on the web at PCRadioshow.org. And today is April the 17th, 2013. And this is the Personal Computer Show.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. This is Joe King. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. As Stevie DB has just introduced us, we're broadcasting to you from the facilities of WHCR up in CCNY, or is it CCUNY?
No, CCNY as part of CUNY.
Which, for those of you who are listening over the internet, means City College of New York, City University of New York City, and we are using the wonderful facilities of the Voice of Harlem here in New York.
Voice of Harlem.
Today's show is going to include, is David up with us yet?
Of course.
No, I'm just a Fig Newton of your imagination.
The Fig Newton of my left coast imagination. Hank Key is with us. He's the, I guess if you're the Fig Newton, what is Hank?
I sit on your left.
Yeah, you know, after 30 years of broadcasting, I'm used to Hank being on my right, and lately he's been on my left, David, so I don't know what to do about him. This is going to be one of our regular shows.
Hank is the Twinkie.
We will be taking limited phone calls. Stevie will give you I'll give you the number. It's going to be, we're not going to take them until the half-hour break, but it's going to be 212-650-5782. It's 212-650-5782. Every week we seem to give you a different phone number because we're still in a state of flux. You know what that means, don't you, Stevie?
I'm not going to say.
Okay, but you know how to spell it.
Isn't that what you put on solder to keep the oxygen out of it?
That's correct, and I have very little oxygen going for me right now. But I do understand that we're going to have several parts to tonight's show. One part is going to be a continuing series that Hank has started doing some weeks ago, and we're now up to, I think, part three, are we not, Hank?
No, part two.
It just seems like three. Well, when Hank tells me anything, it always seems like more than it really is. But he'll be giving us part two of the Do-It-Yourself Guide to Personal Computing. David, are you going to be giving us part two of Malware Incorporated?
No, we're not going to be talking about malware tonight, although we're going to be talking about something involving malware that comes from a question that came up in email about somebody who wanted to know what to do because their system was infected and what to use.
I remember that email very well. And, Hank, why don't you start off tonight's show with some news items?
Well, let's take the first one because there is quite a bit of confusion. Microsoft had a patch that went out, and some people say it got pulled because it was applicable to a private company and it shouldn't have gone out. Others said that, no, it actually was more than that. There was like 3-4 days of it in a row. David, you probably have the latest update on this patch that got pulled from Microsoft.
No, as a matter of fact, I don't, although I do know that it was pulled because of security reasons.
Yeah, but they said that it related to an application of a private company, and it was only one affected, and then they pulled it back and they say, no, it had to do with Brazil, and then they pulled it back and say, well, it may affect some of them.
And now the latest thing is they pulled it back and said not only do they think you should uninstall it, but they've withdrawn it from circulation. And obviously all the first comments that they made, and therefore Hank just made, were absolutely false. And it comes back to something that Michael Horowitz has said numerous, numerous, numerous times. Michael, as you know, is our webmaster, but he's also an expert in what is termed defensive computing. He has a blog to that effect and used to teach courses in it. And one of the most defensive things he feels that we should all do is never, ever, ever automatically install a patch from several companies, Microsoft included, until it's been out there long enough for them to withdraw it when they discover they shouldn't have released it in the first place. Hank?
Well, the patch is KB2823324. Let me repeat that.
Yes, please do.
KB2823324. And the way to uninstall it, what you do is you go to the control panel and you go to Windows Update and you go to the update history. And you look up KB2823324 and click on that and go to the top and say uninstall.
Has Microsoft done an automatic on that? If you go to
well,
their website?
Well, the thing is, Microsoft can install, and actually, I have not had experienced anything that Microsoft uninstalled. They have snuck things in, okay? Well, let me put it this way. Look for it, all right? If you see it, be on the safe side, KB2823324, and I'll have Michael post that up, all right? And That is, just go to the Windows update, look up Windows installed history, click on it, and do an uninstall. All right? And rather than continue the confusion, we'll move on to something else because it's one of those things where, yes, it has to do with Brazil. Yes, it has to do with a private company. You know what? Until everyone understands what it is, we'll just say, hey, just uninstall it. The other thing, by the way, Dave, while we're on this, tell me, what was the thing that you were trying to solve on the virus that you were talking about?
Oh, somebody wanted to know what was the best. We'll get to it later. We want to talk about standard operating procedure for what do you do with an infected machine. And they were saying, well, what product do we use? And I have a whole procedure I want to go over.
Exactly. And let's put that off for a separate subject a little bit later, Hank. What else do we have in the news?
Well, we also have the fact that I mentioned this article to Joe, and he says, gee, I think you better vet it because, is anyone else reporting on it? The answer is yes. Seems like about four or five sources are reporting the same thing. And it was a company by the name of Nature Materials, and they found that charged memory can emerge in common electrode material in lithium ion phosphate. Translation into English language is that the lithium ion-based system might misreport the charge state of the battery, so that in effect, you think that the lithium battery is charged and it's not. So, we were always told that with lithium ion batteries, they stay charged until you expend the energy on it, and then you can then recharge it. Well, I guess it doesn't work that way anymore.
Well, how does it work?
You know what? First of all, you have to maintain the life of the battery. In other words, when did you buy it? There's a program that I know that we use. It's called HW Info 32. If you were to Google that, I shouldn't use the word Google because now I'm pushing Google as a search engine, but you could use Bing, you could use, or the other search engine. HWINFO32.exe. What it does is that it's basically a hardware diagnostic program, and it tells you like little things about your hardware, like what's the fan speed running at with each of the different fans you have. But one of the most important things it has is that it can tell you what is the wear and tear level of the battery that you have. In other words, the life of a battery is if it's there's no wear and tear on it is 100%. In other words, the capacity of the that you can charge is 100%. However, as the battery wears down, the charge that it can maintain becomes less and less. And I find that it's a pretty good indicator. I used to have a battery used to last for 2 hours, and now it's down to 5 minutes. And when I ran the program against it, it showed that it was like 90. The wear and tear was 95%, and I have not replaced it because I just keep it on AC. It's not worth repairing.
Well, it's not just on computer batteries, Hank. I had the exact same thing on a Samsung smartphone battery.
That's a computer. A smartphone is a computer.
And I contacted it. It had the Samsung brand name on it. I had bought it from a third-party company, an aftermarket company, and I contacted them. And they said, yes, they've found a number of people reporting the same error. It's covered by a one-year warranty, of which they sent me a copy. And the copy said that if I sent them a check for $2.95 plus postage of $3.50, they'll replace the battery and return the battery to them.
Well,
replace it.
They say that lithium battery, if you're using it on a regular basis, is good for 3 years. I would say that that's pretty true, although I've had one system where the wear and tear on it started after 1 year. So if you have a lithium ion battery that's already in its past its third year, run a check on it. In fact, you know what? It's a great program to use. Run a check on it to determine it actually determines the actual capacitance of the battery and what the wear and tear level on it is. It's a very good diagnostic.
Until quite recently, I traveled full time for a living, and I mean that's
in excess of 200 days a year for over the last 20 years, and I almost never run my laptop off of a battery. Almost never.
Well, if you're not using the battery, technically you should remove the battery and use it on AC. But the fact that you, on some systems, they keep charging that battery and they overcharge it. Some systems will cut off when it's fully charged. So not knowing what kind of system you have to be on the safe side, I have yet to find a system that when you take the battery out, you can't use AC. All of them will allow you to use AC.
See, because I don't even have a use it the battery. Occasionally, I'll get up to do a PowerPoint presentation, and it's too much hassle to crawl around under the podium and plug in the laptop. But generally speaking, you're in a hotel room, or you're in a conference room.
You plug
and
it
that's
in.
That's about it.
Well, both of you guys are not looking at me, obviously, because here I have my computer in my hand, and I'm running on a battery.
Well, what does it say?
It says that I should uninstall 2823324.
Okay, I see what you're driving at. Last week, I started.